Even when I come to the hospital and I see you in your fucking nerdy ass lab coat and shit, I always make sure people understand that you're a great athlete because I feel like I, you know, got you there. I beat your ass every day of your life. I made you a man. I toughened you up. All-American football, all-city DC basketball, played D1 sports. Well, anyways, you were good in baseball, which also was frustrating as shit.
Today is a very special guest, one that I've known for his entire life. It's my little brother, Nick Bernthal. Nick was an All-American athlete, played Division I sports, set up hospitals all over the world, and has now become one of the most revered cancer surgeons in the country. For as well as I love and respect and know my little brother, today I feel like I got to know him a little bit better.
Look, Nick, you got fucking cameras on you, dude. That makes you nervous? Huh? You know, in having this conversation, there's always a need for me to explain, and I have to explain to everybody in the room that that Nick, my little brother here, is actually like an elite athlete, right? And I say
you're
that because
I don't look like that.
You definitely don't look like it. And the thing is because I I do take that as my response. I beat your ass every day of your life. I made you a man. I toughened you up. But like what you, All-American football, all-city DC basketball, played D1 sports, and good at like really all fucking games. It's frustrating. You play baseball, like your junior and shit? Were you all-league in baseball? Were you all-league in baseball? Anyways, you were good in baseball, which also was frustrating as shit. Like even when I come to the hospital and I see you in your fucking nerdy-ass lab coat and shit, I always make sure people understand that you're a great athlete because I feel like I, you know, got you there. And I guess, you know, to start, man, I wanted to know, like, from athletics, like, what is some shit that you have taken from sports?
You know, I think for me, sports kind of started out just being something about when you're the youngest brother, sports are a way that you can engage with your older brothers. And for us, as you know, I mean, growing up in a house with guys and sports all around everywhere, it was for me a way of kind of being included, that I felt like if I could kind of be good enough to play in that game, that was it. Like, mm-hmm. That's the goal. Mm-hmm. That's the goal, is being good enough that you're not kind of the weakest link in a sport. But, you know, then from that, I think, you know, there's all the cliche shit, the relationships and the growing up in DC and the kind of the links it made across. But I think deeper, you know, the deeper friendships, when you start talking about things that actually put people on an equal playing field, I've always just really kind of, I've loved the idea of sports. It's one of the few areas where everybody puts on a uniform, and it doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what your parents look like, what you look like. I mean, none of this stuff matters. And so it always felt like it was this place where it's a true meritocracy.
Fuck yeah.
You create your identity and you earn your identity, and nothing's given to anybody. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that was a big part of it. I mean, DC is a multiracial city. It's a multi-background city. And yep. and there just aren't that many places that
equal opportunity. It's just like you're judged by hard you work and how much you get each other. And growing up, sort of like how we did and where we did and when we did, I think was just so like just unbelievably unique. And I think everybody has their own sort of relationship with their upbringing. I'm constantly going back to how we grew up, and I'm just like so enormously grateful for it. And first I just want to talk about like just like the environment of that. And you know, I was thinking about you today, and you know, and like in the course of your life, like growing up as like a high school student, you know, you drive your little shitty ass car to the fucking White House. You know what I mean? Like your fucking broken down car with no air conditioner, no radio, and
car
like
was amazing.
And like pull up at the White House and like watch football with Bill Clinton. And then you also had, you know, dear friends that, you know, who parents were, you know, first generation immigrants. You had friends whose parents, you know, your best friend's dad was a cop. You know, you had friends whose parents were incarcerated. You know, we knew kids that, you know, had been incarcerated, been shot and killed. You know, there's just such exposure, I think, in a city like DC at the time we grew up, where you have this like unbelievable power center, but it's also just this city with its own, you know, super vibrant culture. And it was a violent city and an alive city and an artistic city. I'm just wondering, like, how do you feel that, like, how would you characterize the way that we grew up and the environment we grew up in, and like, how has it served you?
I think as far as like the dynamic of DC and how it's, I think one of the really cool things is that there is a sort of genuine peace and comfort level in almost any group that comes out of growing up that way, where you can really give people a shot, where you can really sit and not worry about what you look like to them or what they look like to you mm-hmm. on kind of first pass mm-hmm. if you grow up in an environment like that. I mean, part of it is that the valued resource in DC was never wealth, which mm-hmm. gets passed down. Mm-hmm. It just never was really about mm-hmm. wealth. It That's was never about fame, mm-hmm. which in, you know, these famous families in California, these wealthy families in New York.
Yeah.
DC was never really about that. I mean, things change so fast. There's elections. This guy is the most important guy this month, and then the next guy. But you know, in DC as a city, it really felt like the things that were valued were much more kind of what you had to say, what your thought process was, and integrity,
how good of a friend you were.
Yeah, I mean, those things really seemed to just be there.
And you know, obviously, like, you know better than anyone else. Like, nobody needs to sit around and listen to fucking my ass, like, pontificate about politics or culture or any of that shit. I've just been, you know, really just like disturbed and disappointed at like the state of discourse right now in the country. And I think it's just like, we're listening to the wrong fucking people, and it's like, loudest voice in the room wins. And I think that that's against like everything that I believe in my heart and my soul and how we were raised. And I think we're so fucking divided right now that, you know, strength and sort of patriotism is just all about bravado. It's all about bluster. It's like, how hard can I fucking cheer for my team over here? How stringently and stridently can I hang on to my fucking point of view? And that's mistaken with strength and masculinity and fierceness. And so I guess like what I'm really trying to do is expose people and like bring in like interesting people that I think embody wisdom and strength and education and discipline and integrity and kindness and empathy. And I think I want to just like give examples of that. And like, honestly, man, like, you know, even though I do take a lot of responsibility for, you know, all of your success, I think you are a perfect example of that. And when I think about people who I would want in my corner, I can't think of anybody more than you. But I also think about just like the way that we were raised in our house with my mom and dad. And when you think about it, you know, look, our parents eventually were foster parents and literally brought kids in our house, raising themselves. But like for 40 years, man, like, mom had a fucking open door policy. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't matter how fucked up you were, how much trouble you were. You could be running from the police. You had a hot meal and a bed in our house. Like, you were part of our family. Pops like always had an open door. Like, no matter what you fucking did, you could go to him, even without going to us first. Like, you could go to him and he would fucking help you out mm-hmm. and like do whatever he could to like make you okay. And you could bring anything to him. And we grew up, I think, with this like tribe of people. I mean, huge fucking group of kids, and like, you know, really like a competent, you know, powerful group of people now from all fucking walks of life, all races, all religions, all socioeconomic levels. Like, I'm so grateful for growing up that way. And I'm so grateful, like that support and that base that we have. It is the reason, you know, that I feel like I can like go out and do what I do. And I'm sure you feel that way too.
Surgery, we talk about things being strong like palm trees rather than strong like oak trees.
What does that
like
mean?
An oak, and like an oak, if you have a really rigid tree, uh-huh. it's looks really sturdy. You hit on it, it doesn't go anywhere. But in a storm, it falls, right? In a storm, it's rigid, is brittle, and so it's very stuck.
Deep as fuck,
and you can't conceptually kind of fix things. You can't put bones together when they're broken and make it rigid. They actually won't heal. You actually need to make them like a palm tree so they have some give in the system so that they can respond to stress, because it lets the body actually heal and mend and grow stronger. So when you heal a broken bone, the goal is to create a palm tree. You create something with a little give in it. And I think, you know, to me, that's the metaphor that is kind of the building, the solid foundation. It's got to be planted. It's got to be rooted. But like the concern is, does the kind of current climate go so far that you have the overprotective side of things in growing up, that you control everything and you build it rigid on its way up, and it has no ability to tolerate a storm. It has no ability to sort of respond to stressors. Wow. And so, you know, I think that's the goal. I mean, all of us as young parents trying to raise kids, like that's the environment you're trying to create. And I think a household that says the door's open, whatever you do, I got your back. But I'm going to tell you when you make a bad decision. I'm going to try and teach you from it. We're going to bring in everybody from all walks of life, because you don't know what stressor, what's going to make you stronger, what's going to make you weaker. And so I think that model certainly holds.
You know, I think obviously like right now we're like sitting here in the middle of this fucking pandemic. And there was like two things, you know, that I found like really hit home for me. I mean, I think number one, like losing Adam, you know, like losing our cousin, spent every Christmas with him. You know, unbelievably, you know, probably the most talented person, you know, I've ever, it's like he was the emblem. He meant talent to me. Yep. He was like first sort of example,
that like, dude, he could just, you could throw it in front of him and he could do it.
Blow
he
your fucking just, mind, yeah. Dude. In music. And like, you know, man, it's like, you know, this COVID thing hit and, you know, you were sort of, you know, you were the one that like, everybody obviously was going to and talking to and being like, what's it like anytime anybody has like in the tentacles of our family, which is, you know, probably in the thousands, like people are hitting you up and you're always there for them. And, you know, you were on the phones with the doctors and you were, you know, and like, look, man, like you had to break the news to your aunt and uncle that, you know, that they'd never see their boy again. And, you know, two young girls, a young man, perfect health. And you had to break that news. And I thought about you so much in that, and that like what that fucking must have been like to call, you know, Bobby and Steve and like, and then like, I realized you do that kind of thing sort of all the time. And just like, I know how much empathy you have and I know how much heart you have. You're not like an aloof, cold person. It's like, how do you fucking deal with that? And I guess, you know, what was it like to sort of be faced? Because it was the first time I sort of could go to you on something and you were like, dude, I don't know.
We don't know.
And you don't fucking know. And what was it like to sort of be faced with that and have no frame of reference for it? And like, how common is that?
Yeah, incredibly rare for us as a field. I mean, it's the first time I can remember it. And I think the guys who are a little bit older than me talk about it with the HIV epidemic at the very beginning in San Francisco, that was the feeling, that you just didn't know what was hitting you, but you knew something bad.
Right.
But, you know, I think the deal with the beginning of COVID that made it just uniquely difficult to help patients and people and friends through this is that, you know, I live in the cancer world primarily. And in cancer, man, something bad goes on and everybody coalesces. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. You watch what families do when somebody is suffering and somebody is struggling with cancer. And it can be the hardest thing in the world, but more often than not, man, it brings out the best in everybody around. And infectious disease stuff and COVID, it is the most isolating thing. I mean, you go through an ICU and you saw, especially at the beginning, they were letting nobody anywhere near these people.
You couldn't see your family. You
couldn't see them.
I mean, that was what Bobby said.
Adam said, you know, they held a phone through two windows to say goodbye to his daughter. Like his daughter said goodbye to him through a phone across two windows. And that was something none of us could come to grips with. And you start seeing the isolation of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it was Adam's story, but it was so many people's story of like, I think I'm okay. I'm feeling a little crappy. There's this new pandemic. I'm going to go to the hospital to just get it checked out.
Right.
And then you're gone.
You never see
then you disappear
again.
And you never see anybody again.
That's it.
Is a horrifying concept.
And you know, as a doctor of your level, I mean, we've failed. Like America has like failed compared to the rest of the world.
I just don't, there's no objective metric you can use that doesn't say we've failed miserably. Our system is really good at certain things. Mm-hmm. This has exposed some of our biggest problems. And we didn't, what we've always kind of held on to is once we unleash our system at something, that we had so much upside that we could always deal with it.
Right.
That's the way our health system works.
But this exposed huge flaws.
It exposed some really big flaws in that system.
What does COVID reveal about the American health system?
So for me, it was about not having any central organization in our system makes it very hard to identify best practices and respond to them. So from a system standpoint, it's, you know, you go to the UK and, you know, the 90% of the patients are in the NHS or in the national health system. And so you can see one hospital is doing better than another. Immediately that's recognized. How does that best practice get conveyed to everybody else? In our system, everybody was kind of doing their own thing and trying to communicate as best we could, but it's emails. It's, hey, this is what we're doing. Does that work for you? And it's just because you have a friend in Seattle who happened to do it that way, you're doing it this way in LA. And that's just not, that's not the way to handle it. Then kind of after the initial process, then it just became a thing about who can get resources. I mean, then it became a resource grab. And so suddenly states are competing with states, hospitals are competing with hospitals. And like the reality is like, there's a finite number of everything.
Right. So rather
you
than
are
like,
by
sure
definition
really
taking away from somewhere else.
Right.
And like that's our system.
Right.
You know? And so once this thing got into a phase of past the first month, at that point, the big rich hospitals were able to get stuff. The less resourced hospitals were not. And everybody started fighting over the same resources.
Is that why more poor people and people of color are dying from this thing?
Well, so I there's a combination. I mean, these are things are all multifactorial, but you know, for sure that there is better, there is care that we can provide at our hospital because of the resources we have that are not being provided at other hospitals. Now, whether people are dying because of that, or in addition, there are medical problems. I mean, now we know obesity leads to big problems. There's obesity in underserved communities is a huge problem.
We're also like living in a country right now where there's like so much conspiracy theories mm-hmm. and there's so much like that just like ripe with just like bullshit. I mean, like, how do you feel about conspiracy theories? Like, are they dangerous? And like,
the whole thing is, I mean, now it's spiraled into madness and it's gotten to a point now where, you know, I try and think about this. If you break it down to a microcosm of a patient walks in who's got a cancer, mm-hmm. right? I'm about to go through this treatment, what I think is going to be the best shot they've got. If we don't establish the ground rules of they've got a cancer, if they don't buy that they've got a cancer, if they don't buy that the cancer will kill them if we don't go down this road, if we don't buy the facts kind of going into the system, my discussion about how to treat them is totally a waste of time.
Right.
And they can't get there. And so now we're just, unfortunately, like culturally, we're in a phase of no underlining facts or trust to start this thing. And you know, not to get overly political with it, but it's like, it's just, we're in an undermined culture right now. And with COVID, that's what we missed, is that nobody from the beginning said, here's where we are. Here's what this is the facts as we know them. They are going to change. This is a disease we don't know that much about, but here's what we do know. And, you know, the unwillingness to have the hard conversation up front, this desire to like, just make things into the facts we want them to be.
Yeah.
I think is one of those things that like any cancer patient will tell you, that's just not how the world works.
Right.
Like that's not, you get the set of facts you get,
right.
And then you've got to make decisions
that's
with
it.
Them. And if you can't accept that starting point,
is that how it worked in other countries? I mean,
that's how it worked, of course. Yeah. I mean, that's other countries.
That were successful.
Countries that were successful say, this conversation sucks. I'm an elected political leader. I got to lock it down.
Yeah.
You're going to, businesses are going to close. Right. Bad things are. You're going to fucking
hate
like me.
You might fucking hate
and
me.
And you
for
know what?
It. Yeah.
I say this to every patient who walks into my office when they come in with a new tumor that we haven't biopsied. I say, look, I have to shoot straight with you. I look at thousands of these images. This looks like cancer. Mm-hmm. This is probably going to be something bad. I hope that the next 20 minutes when I talk about what's going to happen if this is cancer, I hope that 2 days from now when we get the biopsy results back, I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. And I hope that you're a little pissed at me.
Yeah.
And you say, look, man, why did you put me through the last 48 hours of worrying about this? Yeah. But
I'm a grown-ass man. I'm going to tell you this.
I'm an adult. You're an adult or a kid.
Yeah.
And amazingly, the kids are even better at it.
Yeah.
But you say, like, I have to tell you, if I'm sitting here saying, damn, in my head, this is a cancer.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, well, I hope this is just a little infection that antibiotics will take care
right.
of. Like, that undermines everything going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Because then when I break the bad news to you 2 days later,
right.
you're sitting there saying, was he holding back? He
right.
did keep looking at the screen. And when the fellow came in, he kind of gave him that worried look.
Right.
Like, do I have to read into everything this guy said? And that's what we missed here.
Yeah.
If you don't start from having the conversation that's just transparent,
yeah.
that says, these are the facts, as best as I can give them to you. I'm not perfect. You're not perfect. But this is what we got as a starting working place. I would rather have you informed and then saying, damn, that guy had me worried about something he didn't need to be.
Yeah,
so, you know,
yeah.
I went on that traveling fellowship a few years back. And that traveling fellowship started out where five surgeons would represent the United States and Canada and North America and go to Europe and travel around and teach them what we're doing as best practices. And they would teach us best practices. And then the next year, they would send five surgeons back here. And that's the way information used to be passed. That all came from World War II. Bunch of surgeons went over in World War II. American surgeons went over and volunteered to help the British. And they were like, oh, you guys are doing things differently than us. How can we learn from each other? So after the war, they were like, we have to make this an actual exchange. That was medicine in 1940s and 50s and 60s. Now, you know, the day I come up with something new, I mean, my lab works on stuff all the time. It's 2 months from when we discover it to when it's published.
Mm-hmm.
It's out in the literature. It's searchable all over the world. I get an email a month, you know, a week after it's published from someone in Abu Dhabi saying, I'm working on this. Hey, what did you guys do to get to this step? You get some. So the idea of going it alone is so absurd.
It's not going to happen anyway.
It's just totally, totally absurd.
The doctors are all talking.
The scientists are talking. The doctors are talking. The only thing it can do is create, I mean, the go it alone concept it is a financial concept. It's who has ownership of this stuff. Where is the intellectual property? Who's going to benefit from?
Bullshit.
That's not about driving the science
right.
forward. It science is past that point.
Right. I guess, like, first of all, like, what made, like, I don't even know if I know this, but like, what made you want to be a doctor? I was kind of doing my own thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So I guess, you know, the big kind of transition point for me was living in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went down there and I was kind of working on, I was a politics major, as you know, in college, and I was working.
I actually didn't know that. I didn't give a fuck about what you were doing.
I'm sure.
You know what I'm saying?
But I mean, you know, I went down there at a time that I kind of thought, boy, how much has changed since then. But
right.
I mean, at a time when, you know, I felt like Mom and Dad always talked about the 60s as
mm-hmm.
being like the time when history was being written in the United States.
Yep.
And that was the exciting time. And we grew up in the 80s and 90s. And like, it was an amazing time to grow up.
Yeah.
Amazing place. But I didn't feel like we were writing America's history.
Sure.
And at that time, I thought the most interesting place in the world was South Africa. Like, Mandela had just, you know, taken over, was transitioning to Thabo Mbeki as the next president. Like, it's apartheid had ended within the last 6 years. Big changes. And they were writing their history. And so I went down there and I thought, you know, I'm going to get into politics. I'm going to work on politics. This is where the most interesting issue of our time is. And, you know, I got down there and partly was the timing of it, like everything else in life, you know. But I got down there and the big pressing issue was health policy. And at that point, HIV in South Africa, more than a third of the population had HIV.
Damn.
And they were trying to figure out what to do. And it was one of those super interesting times. So I spent my time kind of comparing and contrasting Uganda to mm-hmm. South Africa. Mm-hmm. And Uganda was this country with a military dictator. It had the worst HIV epidemic in the world.
Wasn't it like you have to rape and a virgin? You have to sleep with a
crazy,
virgin?
Crazy, crazy yeah, stories about what you need to do, how you... But they had a dictator who in the early 90s said, this is going to wipe out our country if we don't respond to it. And so he said, I'm taking action. He started putting up signs about safe sex, abstinence, condoms, whatever it took. He saw that it was going to ruin his country. So you have Uganda, this horrible, quote unquote, military dictatorship that went from the highest rate in the world of HIV down to a very, single digits.
Wow.
In a period when South Africa, this new democracy, the Rainbow Nation, Nelson Mandela, getting all the world's accolades, their rate went up in the same time up to more than a third of the population. And so I was down there trying to figure out what we could learn from Uganda, how we could apply it to the South African experience, how we could. And I mean, sadly, because I mean, you know, I'm a pretty optimistic person. Like what I figured out down there was that there were political obstacles that were not going to, that my impact was never going to be like meaningful. What? At the end of the day, and this is one of those things that's just so sad to say, but like, you know, the South African government was so politicized at that time. So you know, it's 5 years after apartheid. Thabo Mbeki is a new president coming after a legend, Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
You know, Mandela hands him power. And he says, you know, look, I've gotten us through apartheid. I've gotten it so the economy didn't totally collapse. I've convinced people there's a future. I've aligned everybody. But now the country's yours. You got to do the next steps. And Mbeki got swallowed up, man. He just unfortunately got in this position where he said, HIV, despite how bad it is, I can't solve it. Mm-hmm. There's no cure. There's no drug. What am I supposed to do? So the only thing I can do is basically push it under the rug because we need political successes. We're a young black government in Africa that many people are trying to prove we can't govern. Mm. Many people are out there. Their biases are to show what a failure we are. Mm, mm. And so I can't take on an issue that doesn't have a path to success. Right. And HIV is an issue that I don't know the path to success.
Right.
And he recognized that for better or for worse, and it turned out very much for worse. And he basically said, the only thing I can do is kind of sweep it under the rug.
Sure.
And what they did, I mean, they used, the first year I was down there, they used their entire HIV budget on making a play.
A play?
A theater play. That one of Mbeki's family members was running, was the producer of. No, but they made a play to, like literally, it was so crazy. They started with condoms, and then they stapled the instructions to all the condoms. So all the condoms had two holes in them.
Oh, fucking A.
Millions of condoms.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So you had these things where it's an issue they didn't want to address. Right. They then had a couple of political missteps at the beginning of it. And then they just said, we got to get away from this thing. Like HIV just ain't it. We can't deal with it.
Yeah.
And so what happened for me is that I got there and I was like, that was almost it. What happened for me is I was like, you know, I can work, kind of dedicate my health, my work and my life to trying to help policy positions for this government.
Yeah.
But I don't believe this government has the political will to make changes. They don't want to touch this issue.
Is that similar?
And the doctors were out there fighting it. The doctors were going out. So every Friday I got in this mobile medical clinic from UCT, you know, this Grootsker Hospital. These doctors would get out there with no drugs, no nothing. They'd get in a mobile medical clinic. They'd go out to the townships. And, you know, I'd spend my week being told never go into that area.
Right.
That area is a no-go zone.
Right.
Then you drive in with the doctors, man. People are coming in, hugging them. They're trying to get the best they had. They were like, look, we can help their nutrition. We can help their general health. We can treat their tuberculosis, which is flaring.
Wow.
So
the doctors were fucking taking the fight to it. And the politicians were just talking about that shit.
Not even. I mean, even worse than talking about it. Yeah, I mean, literally running from it because they viewed it as a losing battle.
And that's kind of similar. And
that's where we are.
Yeah, that's where we are.
That's where we are.
Holy shit. I think I know the answer to this, but like, why aren't you the Lakers team doctor? Like, why aren't you like a fucking guy who does sports injuries? I mean, I think I know the answer, obviously, but like going into oncology, into cancer, you know, I mean, that's, I mean, certainly not for the money. So like
I mean, I think at the end of the day, like everybody else's path, you sort of, you tend to ping pong a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you kind of find your way and you bounce off walls. You know, you kind of go somewhere and then you find something that's getting too far one way and then you try and adjust.
Straight up.
And so for me, you know, that's medicine was getting in through seeing the doctors in South Africa. I was 100% committed to being an infectious disease doctor. I mean, that was the natural thing. HIV, that was where my background in the policy side was. And then I remember in medical school, I went in and met with the head of infectious disease. And I said, you know, I'm thinking about this as a career. Can we talk about it? And he said to me, look, if you want to go raise your family in a developing country and not have a home base here in the United States, infectious disease is the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, think about going down a surgical path. Because if you want to go in and have an impact on people, but not commit your entire life to living somewhere away, that you can't do it with infectious disease. And so for me, it goes back to the roots of our family, man. Like I more power to those who do it. But for me, I wanted to have a home base here. I knew that I didn't want to raise kids bouncing country to country and dealing with epidemic. That just wasn't the life that I wanted for the family side. So then I found the surgical stuff and got in with some orthopedic surgeons who did international work where they'd go in and really make an impact. And I saw the impact they were making. And I loved the kind of sports mechanical part of it. The nice thing in orthopedics is that patients really want to get better. It's one of these interesting things in medicine that I think people who aren't in medicine sometimes lose track of. But, you know, it goes back to alignment. And there's no one more motivated than orthopedic patients. It's mechanical. It's all about like doing this surgery, rehabbing so I get my physical life back.
Mm.
And so patients are super motivated. We generally aren't taking care of the very old elderly trying to prolong end of life care. That's just not. And so you're aligned. You're totally. And so that got me all, got me kind of jazzed for orthopedics. I went into the field and, then when I was in my training, like I got there and I did a sports medicine rotation and then right after it, an orthopedic oncology rotation. And for me, it was a way to kind of ping pong back a little bit I realized that I don't have as much empathy as I thought I did. It's hard to have empathy. Like I, you know, somebody telling me that their rotator cuff hurt, like, and their tennis serve wasn't as hard as it used to
need
be.
Need your help, Doc.
I couldn't fake it. I mean, I couldn't even get behind it to be like, and it's no knock on.
Yeah.
It just like that didn't pull me in.
But the kid with cancer.
But you walk in and I mean, you know how much Dr. Eckhart's like experience. I mean, my mentor, you'd walk into his clinic. Every patient he took care of, man, followed him for life. He saw them. They'd come in for their annual visits 20, 30 years after their surgery, bring their kids and grandkids, and they'd introduce them and say, this is the guy that saved my life. He took my cancer out when I was 13.
Mm.
And like, you can't be in that office and then be in kind of a non-life or death situation like that and feel, for me, it just was, that was it.
And when you're in med school, because I lived with you. I mean, like me, you and Erin, when she was my girlfriend, we lived together in New York, and I feel like I didn't really see you. But I really, I mean, I remember like our cat was always in heat, but I don't really have, I mean, I was just so fucking, you know, self-centered. Like I was like a struggling, broke, failing fucking actor who could not get a break. And I was totally self-centered.
You know, the careers people choose and their training and what they go through to get there is all about what tolerance for what type of hardship, like what challenge is your personality allow itself to? What are you willing to take on? And so, you know, if you want to be an actor, like you deal with a lot of uncertainty and you're willing to take on the hard work and the not knowing that if you do A, it will lead to B. That's an uncertainty that like that I can't deal with that.
Yeah.
I went through my whole life knowing if I do A, I get B. If I do B, I get C. You know, you get that grade, you get into that place, you get in that place, you get that degree. And so I never had a day where I thought, man, what if I do all this and it doesn't work out?
Right.
That's not a skill set you need in medicine.
Right.
There's a really big difference in my mind and about like what makes good and great doctors and how you tease that apart. And this is something that, you know, I remember one of the guys at my program where I trained used to always say, never let your patients see you eating. Never let your patients see you eating.
Why?
Your patients do not want to see you as a human being.
Yeah.
They want to see you as their doctor. Like, go eat somewhere else, go hide in a corner, doesn't matter. But your patients don't want to know your troubles. They don't want to know your home life. Yeah. They don't want to know. And it was just this thing. He would put on his mask, his cape, whatever it is, every day when he got to work. And he was like, I am supposed to be this to be a doctor. I think that you can be a really good doctor that way. I do think it's hard to be a great doctor that way. Huh. I think you have a level of engagement with your patients that helps you get over, that allows you to be connected to them in a way that really helps what you do. And trying to find that line between engagement and enough disengagement that you can stay sort of cognitively on the right track and you can stay objective-ish in your decision-making. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, if you can't take on some of the emotional tie to being connected to them, you can make a scientifically correct decision that is not a medically correct decision. And to some degree, I mean, everybody's got to draw their line where they draw their line. You know, like I have kids who die from their cancers, and I can't let that, no matter how much it eats at me, I can't let that not allow me to go in and do the best job or to change decision make. So I got to learn from anything that's happened in my past, but I can't, there are times that you do everything right and cancer, you can do the best surgery in the world and take out the cancer, kid's doing great. 3 months later, the cancer shows up in their lungs and that kid dies. And you sit there and rethink all of the decisions you made along the path. Was it worth it to do that surgery? Did I put that kid through more pain than he needed? Was he gonna die without that surgery? Could I have avoided that? But the next kid who walks in, you have an obligation to sit there and try to go through it with them and make the best decision and not let, you know, not say, man, my last kid died after I did this surgery. That's just not a choice you have.
Right.
So you divorce yourself from that. But I don't know, man. I mean, it goes back to the bigger picture. Like I just I'm much more optimistic about how strong people are than I think a lot of our global narrative is right now. And unfortunately, we live in a world that like is all about trying to convince us that we're weak. Everybody is weak. Everybody needs stuff. Yeah. Everybody is
overly
wrong.
Fucking sensitive.
Everybody
about
is.
Yeah.
And like the truth is I spend my life with people who are getting real tough news.
Yeah.
And people are extremely strong. And families are strong. Kids are strong and resilient. And when you can frame that we are aligned in this, I'm going to give you everything I have. But we're aligned in this, and I can't promise you. I'm not going to tell. Every kid walks in and says, first question, am I going to die from this? Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I can't tell you no, but I think we're going to beat this.
Fuck yeah.
And if I tell them you are not going to die from this, we're broken.
Yeah.
Like we're done. I mean, most of what I do is curative. So most of it, I truly believe we're going to take this cancer out, and you are going to have a very good chance of coming in that day to the operating room with cancer and walking out without it and having your life back. And so that for me, I mean, that's the fuel. That is what you feel keeps you through.
It sounds like most of the time what you are confronted with in those situations is like unbelievable strength and resilience. And
it is crazy. You cannot, it's just like saying you can't watch the news and not be depressed. Like you cannot deal with pediatric cancers and not be inspired. Mm-hmm. Nobody is around those kids and doesn't come out and say like, just very recently, I took care of a girl who, you know, young teenage girl who had literally a 50-pound tumor in her arm. Arm completely non-functional, no nerve function at all. The arm's just dangling literally like a lead weight off of her. And the arm is, you know, that big around. And she and her family had really bounced around to some of the best places in the country, trying to find somebody who would do a limb salvage operation. And so limb salvage means we can take the tumor out, but keep the arm. And an amputation is the opposite. So 95% of what I do is limb salvage surgery. And I think there's a lot of surgeons and a lot of us, like our predilection is to see limb salvage as a success and an amputation as a sort of a surgical failure. And I talked to her about it and I said, look, you know, you do not have any tumor anywhere else in your body. Like this, you got to give this arm up. We got to get there, because if we do a limb salvage, we're going to leave tumor cells behind and it's going to come back and take your life. And you're a teenager and I know you don't want to give up your arm, but it's non-functional. It's not doing anything for you. It's never going to work again. I can't make it work. And she said, no, I've heard this from other surgeons. And I said, look, just make a deal with me. Like, come, let's meet a couple of times. Let's talk through it. Meet my colleague, meet my partner, Dr. Fetterman, who's just amazing with kids, who does the medical oncology side. Just let's go through the process and try. I promise you, we will make a decision you're comfortable with. After a couple of visits, she said to me, she would go for it. She said, I get it. And her parents were pissed off at me. He said, we came here because we heard you were the guy who could do limb salvage and you were the guy who, you know, and they traveled here, changed their insurance, did all this stuff. People pick up their whole families and uproot for this. I mean, if your kid, you can save your kid's arm, man, you'd move anywhere.
Yep.
And, you know, I was really having a hard time because it looked like the parents saw this as a massive failure. And she decided, reluctantly, but she decided after these conversations to go for it. She woke up, and I mean, young teenager, dude, think about what you and I were doing as a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, she's 15 years old.
Yeah.
She wakes up from the surgery with her arm off. And I walk in to check on her and just say, you know, how you holding up in the recovery room? She's 20 minutes out from this. And she says two things to me. She says, can I give you a hug? So I lean in, she gives me a hug with her one arm. And then she says, you know, this must have been really hard for you.
Wow.
And it's like, dude.
Wow, what a beast. Yeah.
You know, you like, you don't go through that. You walk out of that room and like you tear up a little bit on your own and you get away from it. And then you come back and you just realize that like, man, people are strong.
Yeah.
Wow. People bounce back, man. Wow. And wow. She's going to go and kick ass.
You've hit on this a little bit, but like who are the strongest when facing like horrible news? Like, do you find, you know, religious people with great families, people with great friendships, people with love in their life? Like
people who are really deeply religious have an advantage in these really tough situations. I mean, it that's not nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the most interesting things for me was operating in Ethiopia. Like you go down to Ethiopia and, we pray with the patient before the surgery starts. Like you'd hold the patient's hand. They don't get general anesthesia. So they're awake during the operation. Holy so they're shit. Like prepped and draped and they're sitting there and you have a drape and they hold the drape down and the patient leans forward and holds your hand and you do a prayer with them before they start. And they're just good. They are good with that. Like it was amazing. Like their patients were just like, they
so
had
not
such
on anesthesia.
Faith. They have local, so they have a block, so they don't feel
so they watch
their limb.
And you're amputating.
But
them?
They are whatever you're doing, whatever surgery you're
but
doing.
But you're cutting
they're
fucking
wide
people's
awake.
Limbs off while they're awake.
They are. I mean, we don't. Most of it is not amputation. But yeah, I mean, you do whatever surgery you need to, and they're awake with a regional anesthetic, just a block.
Jesus Christ.
But prayer is so like fortifying culturally there. Mm-hmm. And again, it not to group ever, but it just was kind of eye opening. I also, as you know, I operated quite a bit and spent time in Utah, mm-hmm. where it's a much more religious state, and you see how religion factors into these things. And there mm-hmm. was acceptance of bad outcomes and death as God's will. And so it was much less what happened, why, what went wrong, you know, all those questions. Mm-hmm. So I think religion is certainly helpful. And then I think it goes back to resiliency, goes back to being a palm tree, you know, to having in your life seen some storms and knowing that you've weathered them and the people around you have weathered them. You know, I think people who have not seen any hardship have a really hard time with even mild hardship and have a hard time
sure.
kind of seeing through it.
Yep. Yep.
So, you know, one of the big challenges we got into, and part of the reason we're in the opioid crisis that, you know, that's sort of gotten pushed away as a second tier issue right now. But one of the reasons we got there was because the bad players on the pharmaceutical side created intentionally a marketing effort of expectation that you should not be in pain after surgery.
Right. Where in other places, like you're going through something terrible.
You're going to have
fucking pain.
Like yeah. If I'm taking a tumor out and you're cancer free and this thing hurts afterwards,
yeah.
There's a certain degree of that you should be okay with
and
not be numbed to.
Yeah.
And I, you know, people don't need to be tortured, sure. but you know, and so when you operate in other places that I think don't live with the same expectation going in
of comfort
of outcomes being guaranteed.
Yeah.
You know, here there's this creepy culture where something went wrong if it doesn't work out the way you did. Who's at fault?
Right. Right.
And that's a challenging, I mean, fortunately cancer, it's not a huge deal because we are pretty aligned with our patients, but a lot of my colleagues, like, you know, that plays a big part in what they do.
Yeah.
Medical, legal worries.
You're gonna get who's fucking gonna, sued. Who, like, who's, people are filming
like,
you.
Yeah. I'm sitting there trying to do the best I can. And, you know, and so you go to other places and, like, people who don't have access, life is not expected necessarily to work out exactly the way you want. And any deviation from that is not seen as a big problem.
Right.
Like
right.
Life has a lot of uncertainty.
What do you change about healthcare in this country? You know, what is your idea going forward about the best advice that you can give?
So this is where I think I move a little bit away from the sort of my political views party line on this. So I look at what America's role in health as a global issue. So if you instead, you say, you know, if you just focus on our country, probably the right answer to this is focusing on preventative health. I mean, that's the right answer. If you just think like textbook, we got a lot of people with problems that could be prevented with more access to healthcare. That's definitely right. There's no question. I think if you take a slightly wider lens of it though, and so I try and think about health as what's going to move humanity forward a little bit and how healthy we are. And I think there are countries that can work on how best to improve access better than us, and then we can learn from it. And what we're really good at is innovation. It's what our country is good at. And so whether it's for all the wrong reasons, whether it's capitalistic or whether it's because we've got so many incredible scientists, I mean, for decades, our universities were able to recruit the best and brightest from all over the world. And just like so many other things, America was the place to come and do science. And so I think at the top tier, we have the capacity to innovate. And part of that fragmented system that delivers sometimes not great centralized care means that you have more people doing different things and you can actually innovate better in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really create a system that addresses access issues, but does not take away the diversity at the top and the push to be the global leader. And I think a lot of times we see those as competing. We're either going to focus attention toward equality and equity in care, or we're going to devote resources to exceptional care. We're going to devote resources to finding new cures. And if you say I've got $1 and I got to put it in either bucket, then you're right. Like, you got to decide which bucket. But I don't think it really is that way. I think we can support some degree of innovation and fragmented.
I kind of understand what the fuck you're talking about, but I kind of don't.
All right, let me change.
Just fucking like dumb it down a little bit, man.
Yeah. All right.
I mean, for fuck's sake, dude.
So the bottom line
is
that if you have a bunch of different hospitals doing it different ways, it is not going to be an organized system. So in Britain, where they have the national health system, like everybody walks in and they go and the whole idea is get care to be so that the lowest level of care is pretty equal, high.
Right.
But to do that, just like in any other thing in life, to some degree, you're going to bring the top performers down because you're going to focus all the resources on bringing the bottom performers up.
Yep.
And so the problem is that our system is so ill-suited for that, and we lose out on what our country is really good at by doing that. I mean, if we shift to a completely nationalized system where everything is about equality, what happens is innovation and tech and sort of development go away. They go somewhere else where it allows the differential. Because if I think I'm the smartest guy in the world, if I think that I'm going to discover the next cure for a big cancer, I cannot be in a system that makes me behave exactly like the guy who just clocks in and wants to get out 2 hours later
is
just giving whatever the protocol says, this drug to that.
Okay.
And so you got to be able to create a system that says, here's our baseline. We're obligated to treat basic health as a right, but we are still going to kind of be the magnet for the top. We are still going to be the people who push the envelope.
So, and how do you do that? So you're saying bring the bottom up, take it. You got to take care of the baseline issues.
Establish what is core health care,
and that needs to come up.
That needs to come up
no matter what. Because right now
that
it's
just that
the disparity in health is just fucking sickening.
That is not acceptable. I mean, we are worse in many ways. Our bottom are worse off than many very, very poor developing countries. And that just can't be.
Can't be. Yeah.
But it can't be. And this is one of the problems, man. Like everything is so polarized right now. These are seen as binary choices. Do you support the police?
How do you do both?
Or do you support racial equality?
Right.
Like, why can't you support both?
Yeah, fucking
why can't we have a nuanced approach to science that says, we want to invest in both innovation and excellence and reward that, but also enhance the bottom end. And that just takes reorganization. I mean, that just takes investment, reorganization, political will, and effort.
And a nuanced, non-blustered fucking conversation.
For sure.
Just like a
for sure. That something that supports equality at the bottom is going to hurt me at the top, or something that supports me at the top is going to hurt the guy here. It doesn't, it just doesn't need to be that.
Right.
A capitalist culture is going to sell what sells. And so we don't do a particularly good job of protecting our society from things that are addiction forming. And addiction has this negative connotation. We're all addicted. I mean, we're sitting here hugging our coffees. Like everybody is addicted to stuff. And there's no question that we can do better, that we have the science to show what is addictive and what should be avoided unless you want to accept risks of addiction. I think the one challenge is that, you know, we have this other side of our political spectrum that's about freedom of choice.
Yep.
And that's about the right to go get a candy bar if you want a candy bar. And so culture has gotten so toxic about any sort of intervention, any sort of restriction that takes away my freedoms.
Yep.
And so, you know, at the end of the day, you know, in New York, they had the soda taxes and, you know, you have to have buy-in on these things culturally rather than regulation as the driver. My tendency is, quite frankly, to try and that we can educate people a lot better and not regulate people. That we can, I worry about anything that comes off as a ban of behavior because I think it, in practice, turn something into a political issue, which creates automatic friction. And I just think, unfortunately, we have really crummy communicators. Mm-hmm. We have people who have not been able to say, look, you know, yes, a candy bar is going to be available until a candy bar is not profitable. Right, right. That's just, unless we change the whole framework.
It's like, oh, you want your fucking vegan bitch ass.
You want your vegan, you're a California,
yeah.
You're a this, you're a that.
I'm going to eat a fucking steak, motherfucker.
So let's put some compelling people in front.
And just say, this is the deal.
And say, this is the deal. Yeah. You want your kid to be, you know, hooked on diabetic causing sugars and all this. So like, go, it's available.
Yep. Yeah,
like we're not going to regulate it, but let's.
It's like, how do you compete? I mean, I guess what you're asking too is like, how do you compete with the power of capitalism? I mean, you see, every kid in the world is just stuck to their fucking devices and shit, and like there are huge powers at play pushing them towards those things.
Yeah, but I do think the one place we are now, man, I think the one, there's so many scary things about all of the information age and how everything is going shooting around. I do think that compelling messages can be heard like never before.
I think that's
celebrating
right.
people and places that
Fuck
do
yeah.
it right.
Listen, man, I think you got to make fun. I mean, for me, it's like with my kids, I'm always like, look at that fucking nerd. Like, look at those nerds on their phones. Like, those people are sitting there with each other on, like, have you ever seen such a nerd? That fucking nerd's playing video games all way. Like, and like, I don't want my kids to bully kids or anything else, but like, they'd be like, dad, that guy's a nerd, right? I'm like, you bet your fucking ass. Like, go climb that mountain. Fucking go wrestle each other. Like, you know what I mean? We have to be able to like point these things out and it not be like offensive. And look, there's so much inequality to it. I mean, it's like the food that is available in places where people, you know, the haves versus the have-nots.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people are not informed in a meaningful way about what they are setting their families up for. Mm-hmm. And I just believe in the intelligence of people. Yeah. I believe that people are like the coastal elite shit where like we know it, and but the people in the middle of the country just aren't smart enough
that,
to
man.
Figure it out.
Yeah,
like that shit's crazy.
Yeah. But it's like
that was the thing. That was the argument when the HIV drugs came out with Africa.
Well, I was going to say, that's what it's getting bad. It's the same shit. Like
it was
Africa,
like, we all said like, oh, we can't, the drugs are too complicated. How could these uneducated Africans take drugs that are scheduled every 8 hours? What if they don't have a watch?
Right.
We don't, like, these are like fucking insane arguments
right.
for why people shouldn't have access to good information.
Yeah.
And so what our country has to do, what the government has to do, is figure out some compelling ways to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Figure out some compelling people to communicate, and not polarizing and not marketing and not trying to get your political agenda to look good. Like, there are facts out there.
Yep.
There is information out
yep.
there. And so, you know, when we sit and talk about, there are a lot of things that are up for debate. Say they're up for debate. Say we don't know how this impacts things. But if you talk about giving a bunch of McDonald's or candy bars to a kid every day, like, we know what that leads to.
That's right.
That's a right. very clear line. Like, let's be transparent
yep.
about it. And you know, it's just not that hard.
Yep.
One of the most common things I see, unfortunately, is that there's this whole group of cancer survivors called AYA, and it's called adolescent young adult. And these AYA patients are kids who had cancer, and now they're late teenagers. And what happens is the health system drops them. Because as a kid with cancer, there's lots of resources in our health system. There's lots of social work. There's lots of support for the family, everything else. They get cured, and a bunch of them go on to great things. But a bunch of them, this is a really traumatic experience. I mean, going through as an 8-year-old, a year of chemotherapy,
yeah.
being pulled out of school,
Jesus.
Being the weird
yeah.
kid with no hair, being the kid with a limp, being the kid, and that shit does not catch up necessarily. In some kids, it does.
Yeah.
But in a lot of kids, it doesn't. So then they become the teenagers, and they hit the challenges of adolescence, and something hits. And the thing that it combines in with drug use as a kid, because they've been put on opioid. I mean, historically, these kids were given oxys. That's what they were given after every surgery, after every chemo. You hurt, oxy. So many of them have addiction biology in their brain. They go through natural hardship and they're dropped. The pediatric sarcoma cancer people aren't with them. The adult people, they're not really plugged in, because how many doctors did you go see when you were 17, 18
right.
years old? None.
Right.
None of us. Like that's the time you're healthy. The way people deal with it. And I think it goes back to our conversation at the beginning of like, you know, of trying. And that's why it just sticks in my head. This like this palm tree idea, like you've got to give yourself sway. You've got to give yourself room for feeling it when something doesn't go the way you hoped. The family doesn't get, the kid dies. I mean, that shit happens. And if you don't give yourself sway, you will get blown down by a storm. I mean, I think the thing that from my end, that's always been the hardest part to understand about your world is how you deal with the notion or the concept of how much fortune or luck plays into something. And, you know, I've lived with you for a lot of years over the course, and I watched you, you know, I watched what it was, and I saw, you know, the work you put in and the work you still put in every day. I mean, for this, like sit and interview your brother, you like, you know, spent hours on putting stuff together. And, you know, but I do think, you know, you talk about like to some degree what we all care about, how we're perceived. And you know, I think that sort of that notion that acting or entertainment in general, that there's this just like you showed up at the right place at the right time notion that a lot of people outside this world have. And especially now, frankly, as things have gotten polarized, I think a lot of it is like, oh, another Hollywood, like think they have idea. Why do you get to sit and do this show? Like, totally. You're just a guy who happened to be, you know, maybe a pretty face. I don't know what the right, but you know what I mean? So
listen,
what
man,
do you think?
I look, man, I mean, I think number one, I think perspective is everything. And there's no time, no question. You know, again, you know, like living in New York at an extremely hard time for me with you doing what you're doing and really like Aaron, you know, like, you know, completely fucking self-made, you know, never got a fucking penny from anyone, put herself through college, put herself through nursing school, became an ICU trauma nurse, like worked in the biggest trauma centers in the world. And, you know, I would face rejection after rejection after rejection going into these auditions where people would literally be appalled that somebody with ears like mine and a nose like mine would walk in and audition for this fucking sitcom or this WB show. And like literally just like I could feel their disgust in me. And I'm like, fuck, man, I've studied all over. Like I, yeah. I did my shit. Yeah. Like I've been in theater companies. I've been in hundreds of plays where there was more of us on stage than in the audience. And I went and studied in fucking Russia. I got into fucking graduate school, like with nothing. And like I studied and I worked and I worked and I worked and they want nothing to fucking do with me. And the hopelessness of it, you know, there were nights that, you know, I was like, fuck, man, this ain't gonna happen. And I cried myself to sleep. And then like Aaron would walk in at like 6 a.m. after working the night shift and, you know, talk about, you know, holding a guy's hand as he died or you know, holding a young girlfriend of a guy who I remember this guy got pushed down in a fight and he hit his head and he was gonna die. And like Aaron was like with her and with the family and the perspective of that and the things that you guys go through. And it would always just put the, like, what the fuck am I upset about? Like, put this shit in perspective. And I think, you know, perspective is something I think also in our family, I often go back to our grandfather, man. Like, you know, like fucking, you know, him and his brother, like 11 and 13 years old, like escaping fucking Nazi Germany with nothing, you know, running out, like sneaking in the storage of a boat, like getting to America, not knowing anyone, like working in any job they fucking could with nothing, like just scraping by, making money, sending it back, having their parents come, that parents get turned around, like fucking. And the Nazis got him. Like, you know, like, you know, when you think about like perspective and then you think about like, what is this life fucking about, man? And like, for me, like, you know, man, I was a fuck up, you know? And like, thank God, you know, nobody gave up on me and mm-hmm. people stuck by me because, you know, man, like it was like not looking good for a long mm-hmm. time and I could not stay out of fucking trouble. And I could not, you know, like every bad path I was going down, but I found this thing that I fucking loved and that I connected me with something mm-hmm. bigger, and I felt that I was put on this earth to do. And I was like, the one thing, you know, I remember talking to Pop about it. He's like, just fucking work your ass off mm-hmm. on it. Just work. And like, so for me, it was like, look, man, if you have that, that is something nobody can take away from me. Like, I don't need to get hired in a TV show. I don't need to get hired on a fucking film. Like, I have my passion. I have my art. And like, as long, and I am in control of mm-hmm. how hard I go after mm-hmm. it. So everything I do. And look, I think as far as like this thing here, it's like, I don't know what the fuck we're doing. I just know that like, I'm sick of listening to fucking celebrities, man. I'm sick of listening to fucking experts on TV and pundits. I'm sick of listening to people who haven't been through shit talk about things because they're experts on it. And like, so I really, and I understand that it is like antithetical to my success to come out. Like, no one's going to believe me as the fucking Punisher. No one's going to believe me as fucking Lee Iacocca if I'm here fucking telling you about the way we, like, our, like, my mystery and keeping like some removal between me and my audience, that is my fucking currency. So like, I'm super conflicted. I put clothes on my kids' back and food on the table by this acting shit. That's my love. That's my passion. It's my religion. And I know this goes against it. And the last thing I want to do is be another fucking celebrity spouting off. That being said, you know, I think family and a sense of purpose. I remember like, you know, thinking about, like you said, about the 60s and like looking back and the people who stood on the sidelines and didn't do fucking shit about it. And like, what was that mm-hmm. like? Like, I get there's like some self-interest there, but like, you know, man, we grew up with like pioneers mm-hmm. of fucking the civil rights movement and people like, not motherfuckers who like dropped out and fucking did acid and like, were like, peace. They like, motherfuckers who like, you know, we were taught by people. Yeah. We grew up with people, all of our friends' parents, our parents, people who like, got arrested, protested, went down to fucking the South, you know, when it was dangerous, when people were getting hung and like stood up for what they fucking believed in. So look, man, I don't know what the fuck this is, but I think that just like bringing in people who, you know, walk the walk instead of talk that shit and like saying, hey, look, this is like a strong, fierce, educated, kind, empathetic person. Like we can be that way and we can like talk about things and we could talk to people who think differently than us, you know, might just change a little bit of discourse. So I don't know. I mean, that's my fucked up answer, but I mean, yeah, man. I think like you, it all goes back to the family and the base and like what we had and that, you know, the certainty or uncertainty of what I do, it's all perspective. Just how you say you change your mindset in terms of like, you remain hopeful, you remain optimistic. You're telling somebody, hey, you're not going to make it. Your child is not going to make it, but we can do X, Y, and Z. I think for me, I look at every job and I'm like, this might be my last job. I've gone through times mm-hmm. where like, mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm ever going to work again. Yeah. Right. But you also can look at that and you can say, woe is me and oh, this is so hard. Or you can be like, man, somewhere fucking out there, that job is mm-hmm. out there. That thing that's gonna like make me explore, find parts of myself, yeah. I'm gonna get better. It's out there, man. And it could be coming any fucking second. You just reverse the way you look at it, I think. You know what I mean?
But I mean, I think in the end though, it is, it goes back to kind of having some aspirational component to it though. I mean, that's what you're, it's like, there is something about moving the needle, changing the discourse, having you, it, like, you sound like, you know, looking at life like we can do something of value here and like keeping that positivity toward your existence.
For sure.
Just seems like what's lost right now.
Agreed.
And
man.
Like what we are so fixated on these differences, on these, you know, tribalism, on this, what
winning,
looking
losing
backwards and saying, this is what I have more in common with this right. guy than that that's guy. Right. And, I don't know. I just, how we got here is amazing.
It's
just
crazy.
Amazing. It's like, I definitely thought with Obama, like I thought there was this moment of like aspirational unification that we were just like, shit, man, I don't know if it's going to get better, but it sure looks like we might work at it.
But I look, I think the only thing to fucking do now is to stay aspirational. It's to stay yep. like, it's like in, you know, when times get tough, you yep. know, the tough better get fucking going. I don't know what that's fucking saying, but like, you know, I mean, like you got to keep that going and we got to raise our kids that way and we got to raise them to be strong and to stand up for injustice and to and to not not play into tribalism on either fucking side. And I understand there's this fucking chunk of people in the middle here that are not all the way over here waving their flag. They're not over. And this is the group of people that I think,
you know, no voice right
they got
now.
No fucking somehow voice. We got to give them a voice, man. Reason. That's it. Got to talk to them. And got to not judge them. Got to not be afraid. You know what I mean? Yep. And I think that's what the fuck, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, man.
It's cool.
I really appreciate you doing this, man. I'm very proud of you, dude.
Thanks for doing it. I'm proud of you.
Man. Yeah, dude. I love you, man.
Love you too, buddy.
Yeah, man. I could still beat your fucking ass, though. All
right, let's go.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here, everybody. I really appreciate it. If you dug what you saw and you want to hear more, subscribe, like, do all that stuff. It'd mean a lot to us. I hope you dig these episodes as much as we dig doing them. You guys take care of yourself.